guys, and welcome to episode 15 of Trust in the Process with myself, Deborah Chosen. How are you guys doing? I really hope that everyone is well. We are out here. We are actually in the home of my guest today, which I'm really privileged to be here. Thank you so much for having me here. But I'm really, really, really looking forward to having this kind of conversation today. For those of you that aren't aware, this is, of course, Mental Health Awareness Week. And mental health is one of those things that, you know, people are discussing, but I think it's necessary to kind of have these conversations with people who have had their own kind of experiences within this area. It's interesting because this would be the first time really that we've had someone on the podcast to discuss it in this much length, and I felt that there was no one that would be better fitting really to talk about this than with the amazing Sutra. Sutra is someone who has become a friend. We discovered this earlier. We both said the F word and we were like, oh my gosh. So we have passed that threshold, which is really cool. But aside from being a friend, she is also an author, she is a writer, and she's also an amazing artist. So Sutra, thank you so much for joining us today. Really, really, really looking forward to getting into this conversation. So I think before I kind of babble and hype you up anymore, maybe just allow you to introduce yourself and tell the people kind of who you are and what it is that you do.
Hi guys. So I'm Sutra. I am a medical doctor, a writer, a musician, an artist. I am very passionate about well-being and holistic health, and very passionate about vulnerability as well, and how that really creates space for what I call community healing, sharing our stories, building connection, and kind of rising out of things that we all kind of face. That really inspires my work in and outside of medicine. So yeah, that's me. That's who I am.
Okay. And we were having this conversation before, but we were kind of like, oh, am I going to call you Sutra? Or am I going to call you by the name that I know you by?
Because
of course, most people that know you online, of course, will know you as Sutra.
Yes.
Especially if you've purchased the book, if you've listened to any of your music. But I'd kind of thought it'd be nice for you to kind of let people know in kind of bring them into some of your other names.
Yeah, so, well, I only have one that's, you know, I'm going to share on here. Yeah, in my other kind of life, I'm known as Dr. Sylvia Aniakwete. That's what it says on my badge. Mm-hmm. That's what it says in my passport. That's my birth name.
Yes.
Sutra is a name that I was given in medical school. I think it was in 2013. So okay. I've been known as Sylvia for longer, but those closest to me call me both.
Okay. And tell me about the meaning behind the name Sutra, because I'm sure that it resonates with you for different reasons. So
Sutra is the word sutura spelled differently. So S-U-T-U-R-E-R. Well, a sutra isn't really a title you give people in medicine, but a sutura would be someone who sutures wounds and things. Sutures are threads that you put into a wound to kind of bring the two sides of the skin together so it heals in surgery, or when you go to A&E and you've smashed your face and we have to put stitches in, basically.
Yeah.
And for me, that there was that beautiful imagery of a healer, someone who is, you know, stitching together to heal, or to create the space for the body to heal itself. And so for me, Sutra means healer. But then when I was doing my research into the meanings of this name, it turns out Sutra in other cultures like Sanskrit and in other cultures, can't remember, it means art, it means golden sayings, apparently, like wisdom, like wise sayings or morals. Sutras are also holy chants in a particular religion. I can't remember which one it was, but yeah, so it means all these kind of things which actually still fit in with who I am as a person.
It all encompasses you in crazy sense. So who was it that gave you the name, or how did it come about?
So the name came about, so as I said, I'm a writer, and at that sort of, around that sort of time, I was very much into spoken word. And I would perform like spoken word pieces. And I was going home from a lecture one day when I had this piece come to me, like It was literally like someone dropped it on my head. I was walking, I was like, whoa, and I started writing on my phone. Mm. I didn't look up from the phone till I got home, basically. Goodness. Well, I looked up to cross the road.
Of course, yeah, because, you know.
Cause otherwise there'd be no sutra, do you know what I mean, you know?
Still had to live, obviously.
You know, I had to live,
tell for art, yeah.
But I did this piece, and the piece was about healing, and the name of the piece was Sutra.
Mm.
And it was S-U-T-U-R-E-R. And I remember by the time I got home, I had like a light bulb moment of sutra, sutra, sutra. This poem describes who I feel that I am, who I know that I am, and the things that I'm passionate about. And at that point in time, I'd been thinking of a name, because to kind of, I'd be performing as an artist, as Sylvia.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem to encompass everything for me.
Mm.
I wanted a mononym that could just fit for everything, like music, art, film,
everything,
medicine,
that
everything that I am.
Yes.
And I needed something that would remind me of who I am, because I'm very, very, very much into the importance of names.
Mm.
And Sutra reminds me of who I am. When I'm like, oh, what's my purpose? Sutra. An aspect of who you're created to be is to be a healer in medicine and in art. So it just fits.
That's
so basically
beautiful.
My name is Healer.
I love it. I literally love it. No, that's powerful. I love that. And we're definitely going to go into healing a little bit more and kind of what that has looked like for you and kind of how you navigate that in your professional career as well. But one of the things I wanted to kind of start by jumping into is, of course, you are a doctor, which in this day and age, I mean, in every day and age, but we are just like, we bow down, we salute you, we appreciate you. Thank you for what you do. But one thing that I find quite interesting is, of course, those of us that are in the faith in some sort of sense. So obviously yourself being a Christian, at times there can arise a sort of conflict between science and faith, right? And between healing through science and healing through faith and our beliefs. For yourself, obviously you said that you see yourself healing in kind of all these different kind of aspects. So through your music, through medicine. I know that a lot of your healing as well would have been spiritual and can be. How do you find that medicine and faith work together, if at all? And have you ever experienced any kind of conflict between the two in your personal kind of journey?
That is such a good question. Wow. Okay. Well, so the factual thing is, I actually discovered my music and discovered who I was through medical school. If I hadn't gone to medical school, I don't know. Well, I guess we'll never know, really. But that environment, seeing that depravity of mankind and womankind, seeing us in our most vulnerable states, being really close to people who were at the point of death, people who you had to be so many things to. Even as a student, I mean, it's even harder as a fully qualified doctor, but as a student, you're seeing that depravity and you're seeing how doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals have to be a mother sometimes, like as a woman, for example. I have to be a mother, a daughter, an aunt, a parent, a friend, a spouse, you know, to thousands of people every single day. It actually enhanced my faith. More than anything else. It really did. And I was stretched mentally, I was stretched spiritually, I was stretched physically. Just on a physical level, having to study all the time, having to learn so much, constantly falling short, because medicine is a language and you are learning from scratch, basically. It was a lot.
It's
no one's mother tongue. And it makes you appreciate this design that God has made, you know, for the human body, for the mind and for the spirit and for the soul. And you see how all these things are connected. And it's mind-blowing, honestly. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It does. It just makes me think. Did medical school, because you mentioned that, you know, for you, it brought you closer to your faith, in a sense. It kind of brought that out of you even more. So did medical school kind of show you, did it show you a new level of reliance on God and a new level of need for God, if that makes sense? Did it kind of reveal to you that, okay, in this process, my faith is arguably maybe more important than ever, or is important to me in a whole new way?
This is how I kind of view my faith and how it's been strengthened. At multiple points in a week at work, I will find myself calling out to God. I might have a difficult patient or something, I don't understand something or something's going wrong. And I literally, it's not a book that's going to solve it. It's not a change in medication or devices, especially working in A&E.
Okay.
And the only thing that I can call on, the only thing that I can rely on is God. Yeah, I don't know how else to explain it. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It does. It definitely
but
does.
But there is something greater outside of us that connects all of us. And you realize being a doctor that we are limited. I mean, science is one thing, but it is only one thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't give us all the answers. It equips us. Yeah. It is a language. But there is a greater design. And it's so complex, you know, and I realized my limitations as a practitioner, as a doctor. I'm constantly challenged. I'm constantly being reminded that I am an insignificant part of the huge picture. And I guess as we talk more and I divulge more, I'll talk about like burning out or whatever. But those things happen because of a feeling that I must be so much to everyone. I am the doctor. I'm meant to be fixing everyone. I am the healer. But no, you are a vessel in the healer's hands. You are an example of what a healer is, but you are not the healer, the ultimate healer. Does that make sense?
Definitely does.
Am I preaching, girl?
Girl, yes. And so early. Girl, we're doing church on a Thursday. So early into it now. Oh no, gosh. Definitely. That really definitely does resonate. Okay. Kind of separating you being a vessel from you being kind of the only one to achieve this kind of healing. You're the vessel through which God heals. So that's powerful, definitely. So I've been doing this thing recently for quite some time now, actually, where I'm looking back on what I wanted to do when I was young. So like, you know, everyone says, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to be? And I've been looking back and kind of tracing other elements of the things I used to say in what I do today. So for example, like when I look back, I went through a phase where I definitely wanted to be an author. Like Jacqueline Wilson was my everything.
She's
you
bae. Are, yeah,
right?
Jacqueline, yeah.
She was just talking about her today. In fact, she's still bae. Honestly, like, she's invited to the cookouts. But but I look back and I think, okay, so you wanted to be an author. Whilst I'm not necessarily that as of now, I can still see writing is a big part of what I do. Do you understand? And I'm quite a big believer in the fact that sometimes the thing that we wanted to do when growing up does elements of it kind of aligns with what we're doing today. So what I'd kind of love to hear from you is, when you were growing up, what was that thing? What did you want to be when you were growing up? And do you see any kind of correlation between that and what you're currently doing?
Yeah, actually. Okay, so what did I want to be? I wanted to be an actress. I always joke that drama school was plan B if med school didn't work out. And, you know, maybe one day I'll go into that. But I would say I've been a writer for as long as I can remember. And words really come alive for me in a way that a lot of things don't. I never wanted to be a writer because it was just what I was.
Yes.
But acting was a way of translating the words into an action. It was all very kind of like, ooh, I want to be that. And I was also very attention seeking. So I wanted that attention.
So you maybe always had that element of enjoying being a performer.
A performer. I love, you know, and obviously like putting on all these accents as we're talking. It just, it's something that I love doing. And I did drama in school. It's just something that I've always loved. I think I find it easy to... Because I love stories and I love words, I find it easy to assume the form of those words and translate it into an experience.
Okay.
So that's acting.
Yeah, whether that be acting, whether that be writing, whether that be writing music.
Yeah,
for example,
exactly.
Singing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, you're reading me like a book.
Well, see what I did there.
You're
such an author,
I know,
honestly.
I know, I love it. But yeah, that was, I wanted to be an actress, but apart from that, I didn't know. In year six, the teacher was like, draw what you want to be in future. And everyone was like, oh my God, like, I don't know what I want to be. So I literally, I looked over my shoulder and my friend next to me was drawing a doctor. So I drew a doctor. I'd never thought of being a doctor before. About.
Really?
But that's a message, girl.
That is a precious story
that
right
is
there.
But girl, do you know why I stuck with the I want to be a doctor thing initially? I was like, oh, well, if I'm a doctor, I can tell people about God.
Really? That was the origins of
that was the origins of it. I was like, wow. Oh, doctor, boom. Okay, well, I can tell people about God.
Just through the kind of the close proximity.
And encourage them and remind people that
people
God's
are in a vulnerable
there.
Position already. Exactly. So it makes it easier for you to have
and
those conversations.
It's remarkable because at that point, I hadn't come into faith on my own in the way that I did later. Mm. I was brought up in a Christian household or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, how interesting. There was that childlike, I want people to know God.
Wow.
And that was how I saw that being lived out.
I love how God orchestrated that, because imagine if that person drew, God forbid, a stripper.
I mean, you know.
If they started drawing a pole, you would have just drawn the pole.
You know, girl.
We might not be having this conversation today.
I mean, we might.
No, we wouldn't. Okay. I'll tell you for a fact, we would not. We do not do that up in 3. I'm just joking. But wow. No, that's powerful. That's powerful. And I wonder as well, because, you know, when you look at a black woman in the medicine industry, if you could kind of call it that, or operating as a doctor, it kind of spurs for me on questions about representation and as to whether you ever saw anyone like you within this kind of space. Because I think for some people, we maybe aspire to do certain things, but then when we look in that arena and we can't see ourselves, you know, the aspiration can die. So was representation something that you found within the medicine? Like, did you see other people that looked like you? And if not, how did you kind of navigate that? Or did it not even matter?
Oh, it mattered.
Okay.
It mattered. It really mattered. No, the answer is no. I didn't see anyone who looked like me and I still don't see anyone who looks at me like me, does what I do. Mm. But I guess because I've experienced that consistently for such a long period of time, now it doesn't matter. Mm. But at that point, it was very isolating. It was very difficult. Mm. It was very unvalidating. Mm. Why do I have all these interests? Why do I want to do all these things? Mm. No one's done it before, therefore it can't be done. Mm. So why am I bothering? Mm-hmm. Why am I struggling? And when I was in medical school and I was a blogger and I was doing all these crazy things, at that time it was frowned upon. It was like, focus. Mm. Hello, girl.
Like you're wayward almost.
Yeah,
yeah.
You're basically.
Yeah.
Whereas now that it's more open, you have doctors who are bloggers, who are
influencers.
You know, influencers. Yeah. It's like the thing.
Yeah.
But when I was about to say back then, but I'm not that old. Hello.
Don't age yourself.
A couple years
now.
Ago. Yeah. Okay. But honestly, it was frowned on. And I remember someone saying to me explicitly, are you sure you're concentrating? I think you should put these things to the side. So they were seeing that on its own, but also there were no black female role models for me. Mm. Black female doctors who were role models, let alone black female doctors, writers, musicians. It was like, there weren't. Mm. And sometimes you have to be the first one, or you have to be the beginning of a revolution, as I like to say it.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to be your own representation, I guess.
But it's hard. It's actually really hard.
Yeah.
And I think I know that a lot of my insecurities in medical school was because I didn't see that representation.
Mm.
And let alone being a minority in a, you know, my medical school group was all white, apart from maybe 3 black guys and me, black female.
Wow.
Mostly middle, upper class.
Sure.
And it was very much when there were microaggressions, is this because I am black? And even as a, you know, what's the word, educationally, am I doing badly because I don't understand an aspect of this, or this has not been my experience as a black woman?
Mm.
Or am I overthinking this? Do I need more support? Or am I just... Do you know what I mean? It's really difficult.
That is difficult to navigate.
It's really difficult.
I can imagine not having someone that looks like you in the process. Who do you compare notes with, so to speak, about those things? You know, the microaggressions and the things that only a black woman can't necessarily relate with.
Yeah.
One of the things I'm glad that you touched on is you said that in the process, what was quite difficult really was you're not just a black woman who is a doctor, but you're also this multifaceted individual, because I'm a doctor, yes, but I'm also a creative. I love to write. I love to do music. I love to express myself in other ways.
Yeah. Can I just say I'm only just owning that properly?
Yeah.
Like I used to be embarrassed.
Really?
So I wouldn't say everything. Because it just, it was embarrassing to me.
Where do you think that came from?
I think it came from being not being accepted. So for example, in medical school, being told point blank, like, you can't be these things. So when you're told for so long that you are unacceptable as you are, you begin to compromise who you are, and you begin to think, I must fit in a box, otherwise I'm not worth being, you know, otherwise I won't be accepted, otherwise I don't belong, this is too much, I'm over the top, let me shrink myself. So that's that for me. Yeah, that's where it comes from. And even before medical school, like in normal school, you know, being so many things is a problem, because it's harder for people to digest and label. And that's how it's been for so long, until now, obviously.
That's part of why this really is like a revolution for you then, in that sense.
Yeah, girl. Yeah, you know, I like the R word. Revolution.
The revolution of Sutra. Come through. No, that's powerful. That's powerful. Within being multifaceted, so, of course, you have the scientific side, and, you know, you've established that you're called, so to speak, to be a healer in the space of medicine, okay? And you're doing the whole doctor thing and you're training. But then you also have this creative side, and, you know, you're writing and you're making music. But although arguably, you know, these things were just done personally at one point, but now you're obviously doing them more publicly.
Yeah.
At what point, when you look back, do you think you were able to kind of discover your creative voice? Because I think that a lot of us have that within us and have that inside of us, and maybe you even alluded to it within what you've just said, in that you haven't always embraced all of this. But when would you say, and if it was a process, that's also fine, but when would you say you kind of began to discover who Sutra as a creative is?
That year that I began calling myself Sutra, so that was my third year of medical school, and that's also the year that you step into, like, the hospital, and you're spending time outside of the lecture theatre and, like, getting to know things. And it was a really tough transition, because you go from sitting, listening to lectures 9 to 5 every day, to you're in a hospital, there's lots of things going on, everything's new, and there's the admin side of things, the processes, the hierarchy. It's a lot to learn, let alone the medicine itself. And to cope with the stress of that, I was finding an outlet in the things that I naturally love doing. So, like, writing, blogging, journaling. I got a guitar that year, started playing it, teaching myself how to play it, writing songs, started performing. That's how it happened. It was to kind of cope and translate this anxiety and stress that I was experiencing.
So it was like a creative outlet.
It was an outlet, and it was for me. Initially, it was all for me. The blogging was kind of more for other people. Yes. It was, this is me chronicling my journey
for me,
sure. But this is for all of you as well. Maybe you'll get something from it, maybe not.
Okay.
But the music initially was for me. I would literally sing myself to sleep. Literally, to soothe myself. Yeah, I remember that really well, actually.
Have you always been comfortable with your voice? And I mean that in the most literal sense. So the voice that you used to sing with and you used to make music with, have you always been comfortable?
No, girl, what? Mm. No. I've always loved singing. And I'd always get my siblings to... So harmonies come quite naturally to me. I love harmonies. And I'd get my siblings to, like, you do this part, you do this part.
This is the beauty of having siblings.
I've done the same. Exactly. Yeah. But also, music was how I understood myself.
Okay.
It's the same thing with words. It all comes alive in my mind, and it's like colour and smells and memories. But I was very bad at understanding my spirits and translating it. So I wouldn't, for me, it wasn't so natural to go to one of my parents or a friend and say, hey, I'm struggling with this, or I feel sad, or I feel, for some reason, that
didn't connect.
I didn't know how to do that. Okay. But I could write a song about sadness, and then I would know I was sad. Or I'd write a song about happiness, and then, oh, now I know I'm happy. Does that make sense? It's very weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting, because it's like, it's funny you spoke about you being a healer, but it's interesting that your process kind of began with you healing yourself first.
Wow. Okay. What church is this? Because I'm starting up. Okay, you reading me like a book.
The church was chosen. We are situated in Southeast London. If you would like to come, our services are. No, but yeah.
What was the question? Yeah. I'm lost.
Even me, I'm lost, but that's fine. We can stay here.
No, I actually don't remember the question. No,
it's absolutely fine, because one of the things I wanted to talk about actually was identity. So I wanted to kind of make a bit of a segue into that. And the reason why I want to talk about identity with you is because, of course, I know that you grew up in Ghana for quite some time, right?
GH Town,
what's up? GH, stand up!
We don't speak like that in Ghana.
I know, so it's so off-brand. Ghanaians are listening to this so disappointed.
Sorry,
right
guys.
Now,
sorry about that.
But I'd love for you to tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in Ghana and how that's informed your identity, because I'll open up a little bit about my kind of outlook on identity. So as someone who, I've lived in a lot of different places. I was born in Nigeria, but I lived when I was two, and I've lived in Northern Ireland, I've lived in Scotland, I've lived in Cumbria, I've lived in Birmingham, I've obviously lived in Leicester for uni, and now London, right? So I've been around.
You've been on tour.
My life has been a tour, really long tour, like, is this tour going to end ever? But in that process, I kind of recognised for myself that there definitely was a time when I found it quite difficult to define home, because arguably home was Birmingham because it was the longest time I'd lived in one place, but it wasn't what resonated with me as home.
Right.
And that took me a lot of kind of unpacking, asking myself questions, learning to kind of define. So as someone that obviously grew up in Ghana, but then also London is a place where you have lived and are currently living. How has that kind of influenced your perspective on your identity and the way that you define it? And then if you could talk a bit about growing up in Ghana, whichever order you want to do.
So I was born here, and I actually work in the hospital I was born at.
Really?
How crazy is that?
Talk about full circle.
Honestly.
Wow.
But that's another thing. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, I was born here. We lived here till I was five. And then we ended up going to Ghana. It was just for a short time initially, and then it ended up being for far longer. Unfortunately, my granddad passed away, and my grandmother was there on her own. So we ended up staying for 10 years.
Okay.
And then I came back first, and then my siblings followed.
Okay.
And my parents, my mum, my dad stayed there. He was like, never coming back to the UK. Thank you very much.
So I'm
good. Stayed there.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah, so here till five, went to Ghana for 10 years till I was 15. And it was incredible. It was honestly the best childhood. It really shaped myself and my siblings. I feel like sometimes I feel like I knew myself better then. Or shall I put it this way? I was more comfortable with myself then.
Okay. Yeah.
Because moving back, as exciting as it was, once you got past the assimilating and trying to get back in and dealing with all the, this, you know, it's so uncomfortable when you come back and fitting in and all that. But once all that was done, it was like, who am I? Because now I'm too British for Ghana, in the sense that when I go, it seems like
you're still a bit Western. There's something
I'm still
about
Western,
you.
And then when I'm here, I can't be completely here. Yeah. My heart is not completely here. I'm like this amalgamation of different cultures, which I think most diaspora or most people who have that kind of background have anyway.
Yes,
but when you've lived in the actual continent for an extended period of time, it really changes things. But yeah, Ghana is just, gosh, where do I begin with my art? Ghana is where, I mean, I filmed my first film there because that was me paying homage and my respects to where I'm from. When I go to Ghana, I'm connected. It drives everything about who I am as an artist. It inspires me, my love for words, my perception of nature, and everything comes from my childhood there. I don't think I would see color as vividly as I do now if I'd spent my entire childhood here.
That's really
that makes sense. Everything is rich there.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Do you find Ghana inspiring? Probably isn't even the word. Do you find it inspiring though? Is it a very natural way for you to be inspired in terms of your art when you do go home?
I guess in the sense that if right now I was feeling very meh, I know that I could go back to Ghana as an option. But I found now that there are other options that give me a similar thing. I'll never be able to go back to my childhood and how, you know, that nostalgic thing and all those sweet memories. But the fact is it's changed a lot since then. So For me, I can get the same, a similar thing in Cuba. Okay. I can get a similar thing in Johannesburg. Mm. I can get a similar thing elsewhere. Mm. I've been able to figure out what the equation is or what the formula is. Yes. Do you know what I mean?
To take you to that place.
Yeah, yeah. What the formula is. Yeah. I have my culture.
Yes.
But there's a formula to it. And there's an environment in which I thrive. And I think we need to pay attention to that as we evolve.
Yeah.
So that you know where you need to be in order to be who you need to be.
I love
that.
Oh, so.
Girl, should we put the poster up for church tonight or tomorrow morning?
I mean, I know some people that could do it quick. Let's do this now. No, oh my goodness. As you said that, I had a sort of, not a vision of that sort.
Okay.
But I visually saw something in terms of you speaking about, I think we need to recognize what kind of environments we thrive in. And that's so key. And I kind of saw like a plant, for example, knowing yourself, you need to know in this type of soil, do I thrive?
Right.
Whether your soil is being surrounded by family or your soil is being surrounded by people that affirm you or your soil is a hot country, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
You need to recognize in what kind of soil you grow in order for you to actually grow. So that, girl, that preached to me. I'm not gonna lie.
I think that's awesome you've used that, because my brother especially, he calls me a plant.
He doesn't
I mean, you know, he called me worse things.
Okay, we'll keep that off the podcast.
No, I'm joking. But he calls me a plant, and the reason he does this is I need light and I need space. And I need air, and I love plants as well. And he's one day he's like, "What's wrong with you? Are you a plant?" Because it's like, open the windows, get the light in, somebody
give me photosynthesis.
Yeah,
wait,
exactly. No, literally, and this is something that actually evolved through struggling with my identity and struggling with my mental health, because I went through a season where those things were not readily available to me, or where I felt like I couldn't breathe. I felt like I was in darkness, and that made me yearn for the light. And then I realized I need the light. Yes. I need the air.
Yeah.
This is how I find kind of my equilibrium, if that makes sense.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Definitely makes sense. Definitely.
So, yeah.
Okay. We're talking mental health now. Of course, as I said in the beginning, it is Mental Health Awareness Week, and we were both talking about the fact that we're both very passionate about talking about this. I've never shared that much on it, and I'm sure when the time is right, I will, but I've had my own personal experiences with mental health. More so, I've had my own personal ones, but I'd say the closest one really, the one that impacted me the most was within my family, right? In that very, very close member of my family was going through a different kind of mental episode for many, many years. And I saw the kind of impact that had on our family. And, you know, praise God, things are far from that now. But because I've seen it firsthand and I've seen the way it can impact people, I'm so big on us having conversations about our mind and where we are at. Yeah. Now, one of the things that I love that you do is that you have this thing called pole therapy.
I'm gonna let you explain
that in a moment, but my understanding of what you do through pole therapy is that you're basically getting people to a place where they're able to pursue wellness through being vulnerable. You're really big on promoting vulnerability, and what that looks like from my side, and but I will of course let you explain, is of course, currently it's existed on Instagram, and you have your own kind of page where you run these different kind of polls. And obviously Instagram has become quite popular for that, but the way in which you do them is quite unique, because the questions tend to be very introspective, and getting people to connect with the side, which typically they probably don't normally do so. So I'd love for you to first begin by just telling me a bit in your own words about pole therapy and your why behind it.
Okay, so pole therapy is this platform on Instagram, well, for now, we might be expanding.
Expansion.
But for now, it's a platform on Instagram where I create these polls on issues like grieving, managing money, self-esteem, envy, all kinds of issues. And the idea is people answer these polls, and each of the polls asks, it requests that they pause and they think through, you know, I don't want to say think through their life, but they need to be introspective.
Yes.
And they need to be truthful with themselves.
Yes.
But so what it does is it gives them power to see what might be wrong or what needs work, and to change it. And that's a power that not many people are aware that they have.
Yes.
Because we live in a time that's very... busy, mm-hmm. and where we're so caught up trying to be things, mm-hmm. and trying to tick boxes, mm-hmm. That we don't actually pause to think, mm-hmm. and to reflect on where we've come from, mm-hmm. where we are now, and where we want to be.
Yes.
The other thing about pole therapy, and the reason why I love it as well, is it allows people to see that they are part of a majority. Mm-hmm. It brings back that idea of community, mm-hmm. healing. Mm-hmm. If there is a poll question that, for example, says, let me give an example. Mm. Do you feel unworthy of love?
Mm-hmm.
Yes or no? Let's say you click on yes. Mm. You see immediately that 85% people clicked on yes, mm-hmm. as well.
Mm.
And it's such a, it's like steam being let out of like a valve.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, this thing that I wrestle with, this thing that's weighing me down, I am part of 85% of people who are feeling this right now.
Mm.
And that immediately brings comfort. It immediately removes this idea of, I am on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I am unlovable. Mm. I'm not going to get out of this. Mm. And those are the exact thoughts that we tend to have, which keep us stuck where we are.
Yes.
So pole therapy was about driving conversation, but giving people the power to have that conversation.
Mm.
If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. I never follow up on, did you answer this question? Yeah. Was it you that picked this? Yes, I can see the responses people have, but I don't do anything with it. I never message people about it.
Yeah.
It's giving them the power. It's showing them that they are part of something bigger and outside of them.
Mm.
It's giving them confidence.
Mm.
And it's very much like with healthcare. When we give people the power, when we educate people, they're able to do revolutionary things for themselves, for their lives. Mm. And it affects the entire community.
Mm.
So that, I think that was the first half of your question. What was the second part of it?
No, and just how it kind of began, really. Because I know that once upon a time, it was kind of something that you were doing through your own personal page.
Oh, yeah.
And it expanded, and it will continue to expand, as you said, as you hinted to, but y'all stay tuned for that. But it expanded into its own channel, which of course you've kind of beautifully explained. In the process of doing pole therapy, I appreciate that you obviously won't look into who answered what and whatnot, but I can imagine that you probably do have people kind of pouring out almost from nowhere within the DMs and, you know, kind of sharing kind of different what it's doing for them with you, essentially.
Yeah.
So from that kind of what you've been able to see and maybe what people have shared with you, what do you feel that pole therapy has been able to do for the community that you have created?
It's incredible how God works, because this actually, pole therapy started in November last year. And as you said, it was on my own page and there was no kind of plan or thought process, like, this is how I'm going to do it, this is what I want to do.
Mm.
I just thought, people are doing polls all the time. Mm. Why don't we talk about things that actually matter? Mm-hmm. Shade.
all the shade. It's okay. I'm sipping my tea. So,
so why don't we just do this? And these are all the things that could come out of it. I always use my Instagram story. Oh my God. I have such a cold right now. I'm getting blocked up. Apologies.
That's okay.
I always use my Instagram story to kind of inspire people and encourage them, wanting to use social media in a positive light.
Mm.
And that's how it kind of then led on to just one session. And then after that, I saw people responded to it. I was like, oh, I'll do it again. So it was twice a week initially.
Okay.
And then it grew and grew and I couldn't maintain that. So I brought it down to once because it gave me more time to prepare.
Okay.
The thing, what it's done for people, and I know this because I asked recently and they responded.
That's good.
They said it has allowed them to ask themselves questions that they never would.
Mm.
It's allowed them to pause. It's allowed them to reach out to people that they hadn't thought to reach out for. For example, our session on like forgiveness and things. And it's allowed them to embrace themselves.
Mm.
But the powerful thing also is what it's doing for me.
Mm.
I need to have discipline to show up every week to do these sessions, but also I don't really plan ahead.
Mm.
The topics come to me on the day or a few days before based on maybe something I'm going through or just out of it. And excuse me. And also I always say pole therapy HQ, but the gag is HQ is literally God and me. It's a two person team.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because it is literally God. And through this, God has taught me that I'm a teacher because I'm, and I enjoy it. And I didn't realize that until pool therapy. Do you know what I mean?
I love how the way that God works is that oftentimes things that we're doing or we've created, they are for other people, and that's obviously very important, but there's a way that we also are healed in the process, or grow in the process, or get to know ourselves better in the process. And I love that whole therapy is changing everybody, like your people and you. That's powerful. That's definitely powerful.
I love it.
With pole therapy, of course, you don't try and pretend to be a therapist or anything like that. You're not saying, hey guys, come here and get medical advice, anything like that. You're just opening up kind of the space for people to have these conversations. But we know that therapy, of course, is something that's very, very real. There's probably a lot more conversation about it in maybe the past 3 years, more openly, especially within the Black community. And I'm here for it. Like, I'm glad that these conversations are being had. As someone, and we're going to talk about this in just a moment, but as someone that has kind of had your own experiences with mental health and navigating your mental health, what are your feelings towards therapy? And at this point in your life, or in any point prior, is it something that you've considered or embraced? Where do you kind of stand in regards to therapy?
I think therapy is incredible. It's not something I've done yet, but it is something that I would very much consider. At the moment, my work schedule makes it difficult to have free time to do other things. And also, she broke. Hello, NHS, step it up, pay us more.
Listen, amen.
No, but therapy is something that I really want to start this year, and I'm definitely looking. I think it's beneficial. I think for people I know who've tried it, it's really helped them. And I love how people are becoming more open about it. I think it is a journey, though. You might have a bad experience with the therapist. And, but essentially, therapy is doing things that we don't do enough of as a community in the first place. So say back in the day, our ancestors would gather around a fire and share their stories, have songs about morals or whatever.
Attitudes and stuff like that.
They had those spaces. And so the need for therapy, we didn't really have as much of a need for it because we had those spaces.
In terms of as a traditional institution, as what we know it to now be.
Exactly. But now we don't have those spaces and we don't encourage those spaces. And life is too busy to facilitate those spaces, to be honest. So therapy is more necessary than ever before. Like I said, I don't know anyone who it hasn't really worked for. I'm sure maybe it doesn't work for everyone. But I think it's great. I think it's really
great. I love that it exists and that it is possible. Arguably, obviously, there's still some accessibility sort of issues there.
If you're Black or minority ethnic, you might prefer to see someone who looks like you.
Definitely.
Who shares your background. And so you wouldn't, that would limit your options as well. I know it's limited mine because I want a specific person.
And then sometimes for some people, faith comes into it as well.
Exactly. You know? Which is another limiting factor, isn't it? So, but do what works for you and be responsible. Like, when you need it, you need it. And if you're not sure that you need it, try it if you have the means to try it. If it's not for you, it's not for you, and just move on. Do you know what I mean?
I completely agree, completely. So we're talking about mental health, of course, and I think it wouldn't kind of be fitting if we didn't talk about our own personal experiences around mental health. And one of the things that I really appreciate about the book, so Marrow, if we haven't spoken about it already, so your first baby, your first literary baby, and I have it right here, but in Marrow, you don't shy away from opening up about kind of your own personal experiences in terms of dealing with the mind, right? And whilst it might not always be incredibly explicit, if you want to see it, you can recognize that, if that makes any sense. Within Marrow, you do share kind of your own experiences, and at the beginning of the book you do open up with the following words. So you write, "I don't think a person can ever know how powerful a thing is until they have lost it. For me, one of those things has been joy." And when I read this, my heart was like, my chest because we don't often hear people describing that emotion as "I lost joy." It's quite a strong way to kind of express that, but it really resonated with me. And so I wanted to kind of talk around that for some moments. Okay, so I just kind of wanted to talk about what that experience was, or what your experience of a loss of joy has been like,
mm-hmm.
and what navigating that has looked like, and how you maybe tend to overcome it. Because I don't think that a loss of joy is something that just happens one time in your life.
No.
And, oh God, that was a really bad day that I lost my joy. Thank God I've got it now forever and ever. You know, that's not really how life works. But experiencing a loss of joy, what has that been like for you, and how do you navigate it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm so blocked up.
No, you're okay.
I'm like, come on, nose, I need to speak. So I wrote that line. I remember writing that line, and it was such a summative moment for me, mm. because I'd never really been able to put into words until that point what the experience was for me. Mm. So I guess, so your question is,
what has the experience of losing joy been like? What has that looked like for you, and how have you kind of navigated that? Because I know that within the book at the beginning as well, you begin to tell a story about a particular incident where you kind of recognize that you weren't necessarily well. Okay, so maybe you can talk around that maybe.
So, okay, I'll start from the incident actually, and then kind of work back. So, the incident, I hate calling it that. The life-changing moment for me was that in December 2017, I was on a flight to Ghana, and I started to feel really unwell. I felt just odd. I felt like I had like shivers down my spine, and I felt quite faint, and I was like, oh, I just woken up from a nap, and I was like, oh, was it something I'd just eaten? Maybe I should just go to the toilet and try and like vomit or something. I went and nothing came out, so I went back to the chair and I felt worse. I got up and I made it to the back of the plane, and I felt like my blood pressure was low, because my heart was pounding, and it was very fast. My pulse was fast, and that tends to happen when your blood pressure drops. It's like the body's way of trying to get it back up is to get the heart to beat even faster, to raise the pressure. Anyways, so I was like, I need water to bring it up. And I remember asking the air hostess, whose back was to me, but she wasn't hearing me for some reason, and I felt like I was speaking pretty loudly. So I tapped her, and she turned around, and I must have looked awful, or she was just being an absolute prat, because she just kind of like yelled.
Oh my goodness.
And then suddenly there were all these men around me, because there were men at the back of the plane. I think I looked bad. I looked really bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, I kind of started to fall. And basically, to cut a long story short, because I want you guys to get my book and read it, this weird thing happened on the plane where my blood pressure dropped quite suddenly, and it dropped really, 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 really low, to the point where there was one other doctor on the plane, and he had to put a needle in my arm at the back of the plane. He had to squeeze through some fluids. They had to call paramedics on the ground. When the plane landed, I had to be seen by the paramedics. I basically came close to dying, and it's crazy how God is so present in everything, because the part of the plane where I eventually started to fall was where the doctor was sat. The only doctor on the plane was sat there, and he was one of the men that got up and was like, what's happening? Tell me how you're feeling. Come here. And he's the one who eventually put it in my arm. There was one doctor on the plane. There was one medical kit. There was only one needle. There was only one bag of fluid. Anything, if this doctor hadn't gotten the needle in, we don't have another.
Yeah.
If the fluids had expired, we couldn't, because I was at the point where I couldn't drink myself. I wouldn't have been able to hold a bottle. I was completely weak, and I was losing consciousness. Everything was going. And at the time, I wasn't scared. I was just tired.
That's all for part one of our conversation with the Ever Courageous Sutra. Opening up the conversation around depression, in part two, we look at what a loss of joy can do to you and how Sutra eventually found her way back to herself. Retelling her story, we look at the turning point in her healing process and how faith saved her life. Sutra also opens up about the impact of asking others for help and the healing power of honesty and transparency. We explore fear and how to unpack the things that make us afraid so that we can overcome and reclaim our peace of mind. Finally, Sutra and I visit some of my favorite pieces from her debut book, Marrow. Stay tuned for more.